Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. 7 million people in the world suffer from Parkinson's disease, which interferes with dopamine production to create symptoms that get progressively worse, including tremor, rigid muscles, slowed movements, and speech and swallowing challenges. Synthetic dopamine can help relieve symptoms, but it cannot keep them in check forever, which is why researchers are placing great hope in upcoming human trials of a drug that seems to clear out toxic proteins that form in the brains of Parkinson's patients. If this drug works in people, it could offer new optimism to the tens of thousands of Americans who receive a Parkinson's diagnosis every year. John Palfreyman is here to talk about more than two centuries of research into Parkinson's disease. He is professor emeritus of journalism at the University of Oregon. His new book is called Brainstorms: The Race to Unlock the Mysteries of Parkinson's Disease. John, welcome to Think.
Hello, Chris.
We should note at the outset that you are in this race. After doing a lot of work just covering Parkinson's as a journalist, you were diagnosed yourself.
Yes, it's pretty ironic that of all the diseases I should get, it would be a Parkinson's disease, because I launched my career maybe 30 years ago working on a story about Parkinson's disease, and I stayed interested in the subject throughout. So when I heard in 2011 that I was diagnosed with Parkinson's, it was a bit of a shock, and I didn't react in a very sort of rational way.
Your mother had suffered from something called essential tremor, which is a different condition entirely, and you thought that must be the reason that you were experiencing tremor.
Yes, you see, the symptom I had was tremor in my left hand, but I thought that this was just what my mother had had, which is essential tremor, which is a non-neurodegenerative condition, which is fairly benign. But after I got the diagnosis, it was clear I had Parkinson's.
What is Parkinson's exactly?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I mean, as you said, that traditionally it's been defined as a movement disorder caused by death of cells that make dopamine in the brain. And when these things break down, then circuits in the brain which don't get the dopamine start to malfunction, and you get symptoms like tremor, slowness of movement, rigidity, loss of facial expression, some of the things you mentioned. But recently it's been rebranded as a much more complicated disorder. It's seen really that the classic Parkinson's we all recognize is really like the second act in a three-act play, that it's going on maybe 10 or 15 years before you get diagnosed and then continues progressing to other regions of the brain afterwards.
So if we could know earlier, before people have any symptoms at all, is there hope that we could prevent onset of the symptoms that are so troubling?
I think that's the most exciting thing, that if you had a way of detecting it before you got the disease, because the disease was, the pathological process is probably underway, as I said, 10 or 15 years before, then you could if you could interfere and interrupt that pathological process, then you'd never get the dopamine cell loss and people would never get the symptoms. But to do that, you need biomarkers. You need to be able to sort of diagnose, like with a blood test or something, that a person actually has got Parkinson's in the making. And we don't have that at the moment.
Most Parkinson's patients these days are diagnosed after the age of 60 or so. Is the disease different in people who come down with it earlier in life?
Probably is. About 10% of people get diagnosed at 40 or less, and there's cases of children as young as 15 being diagnosed. And some of these cases are rare genetic forms, which may have a completely different pathology. It may be that the mitochondria, that they're the batteries inside cells, are affected more in these cases. It's a different thing. For somebody to get it at 25 or 30, it's a very different sort of prognosis, because they've got to survive for much longer with this debilitating disease. But as you say, 90% of cases occur in middle age, and I got mine age 60, which is absolutely typical.
Speaking of survival, we should say that while Parkinson's does inevitably get worse over time, patients who receive proper medical care tend to have pretty typical lifespans.
That's right. Before levodopa, which is the principal drug, was discovered, Parkinson patients would tend to die within 6 or 7 years. But now you'll find many people surviving 20, 25, even 30 years with Parkinson's. So it's sometimes said that Parkinson's isn't a death sentence, it's a life sentence. It's more about how you live rather than anything else.
And help us understand this. When you have Parkinson's, movements that, movements that are voluntary but largely automatic for healthy people take more intention for people with Parkinson's to carry out?
That's very well put. I mean, there's a region of the brain called the basal ganglia that tends to do a lot of automatic things. And I liken Parkinson to getting on an aeroplane and flying to London and renting a car and having to drive on the left-hand side of the road. You can do it, but you have to concentrate. When you drive on the right-hand side of the road, a lot of things are automatic. And so that's very similar to Parkinson's, that when a normal person, a healthy person walks, they don't have to think about swinging their arms as they go. But a person with Parkinson's has to consciously do a lot of things like swing the arms. So you can move, but everything's just a bit harder.
Let's go back in time a little bit. Parkinson's is named for the first physician to write about it in detail. Can you talk about the symptoms that James Parkinson began to identify in his patients?
Well, he was a remarkable guy. This is at the beginning of the 19th century. He'd walk around his district where he lived in East London, Shoreditch, and he simply noticed people who walked funny, and he'd go up to them and he'd interview them. And he ended up writing a pamphlet in 1817 called Essay on the Shaking Palsy, where he described really the classic way that Parkinson patients walk oddly. They stoop over, they have difficulty with their steps, and so forth. And his pamphlet didn't really get a lot of attention, but it was refined over the years. And so by the middle of the 19th century, a pretty good clinical description was known of what was Parkinson's, and, you know, a name was given to it. And it was recognized that people throughout history had actually had it. And then I think a bit later on, the connection was made to a certain brain region called the substantia nigra. And later after that, it was discovered that these cells made dopamine. And so that the key neurotransmitter that was involved was dopamine. But Parkinson's has this classic sort of 19th century history where just through observation, people were recognized. And today, you can recognize people the same way that Parkinson did, that they move just a bit oddly. They move a bit more slowly. They've got the tremor. They're stooped over. They look a bit more fragile. Their faces lose expression, and their voices lose volume and more. And their handwriting gets smaller.
Yeah, that was a symptom that a French neurologist wrote about when he actually gave the disease the name Parkinson's disease. And Jean-Martin Charcot was in a really peculiar place, but in the perfect setting to identify this kind of disease. He was working in a very large hospital.
Yes, and they had sort of thousands of cases, and he was able to... Since these were wards of the state, he was able to sort of work out not just the symptoms of Parkinson's disease, but other diseases as well, like other neurological diseases. And among the symptoms of Parkinson's that he recognized and codified was what's called micrographia, which is the writing getting smaller as you... And sometimes you can see it on the page. The person starts writing on the left-hand side of the page, and it's normal, and it just gets smaller as it goes over. And That's this basal ganglia, this region of the brain misbehaving as usual. It's just the estimates we have. You know, when we move, we make all kinds of guesses about how far we have to stretch our hand to pick up a glass of water. You know, what how heavy the glass of water is going to be, and all these kinds of movements are normally automatic, but they become less automatic with Parkinson's, and have to be negotiated with a more deliberate style.
And I guess micrographia was one of the symptoms that really frustrated Thomas Hobbes, the philosopher.
Yeah, Thomas Hobbes, they think Thomas Hobbes almost certainly had Parkinson's. And Aubrey, who wrote The Great Lives, commented on his bad handwriting. So I think that's true.
So, John, what does dopamine do within the basal ganglia for healthy people?
Well, dopamine is a modulator, so it's involved in all kinds of processes. And we don't have an awful lot of dopamine cells, but they have enormous connections. A single dopamine neuron may have a million connections with other cells. And so they tend to tweak a lot of actions. It's used basically in the basal ganglia. The way we learn to do things well, like when we're children and we learn to pick up food and put it in our mouth, or when we're learning to play tennis to do a backhand. When we do something right, we get a burst of dopamine, which is like a reinforcer. It's like it says, you know, it's a pleasure. They call it the pleasure molecule, because you and that's how you learn to build up this enormous repertoire of automatic skills. And so you can imagine that with that breaking down, because something like 60 to 70% of the cells in the substantia nigra, which make dopamine, have to die off before you get the symptoms of Parkinson's. So you've got a massive dopamine deficit now. And so all these circuits, which are used to being tuned and tweaked with dopamine, now don't get it. And so they misbehave. And you get all kinds of odd things happening, which you can live with, but they make everything more difficult.
Dopamine, of course, can make us feel good when it's giving us these little squirts of reinforcement and reward. Is there any evidence that, like, a period of depression might precede the onset of the physiological symptoms of Parkinson's?
Absolutely. I mean, as I was saying before, it was it's more like the way we see Parkinson's today is more like a three-act scenario. And in the phase before you get a diagnosis, there's all kinds of odd symptoms which have been noted. Some of them are things like constipation and loss of smell and sleep disorders, and some of them are things like depression. And I remember, I've never really suffered from depression my whole life, but 2 or 3 years before I was diagnosed, I had a couple of odd bouts which didn't make sense, but in this context, that this may be what they call a prodromal, an early marker of Parkinson's. And and you can see why it would make sense, given the central role of dopamine.
So the world knew this was a disease, particularly when it was publicized by Charcot. But for a long time, goodness, therapies applied to it were like shots in the dark. Can you talk about some of the treatments prescribed for Parkinson's patients before levodopa was found?
Well, doctors could do very little, and they tend to do things like bleeding, bloodletting, and try potions and plants. But there were a couple of interesting ideas. Charcot noticed that people who'd arrived in his clinic after taking a long carriage ride in a horse, you know, with horses and carriage, mm-hmm. a bumpy ride, felt better. And so this led to the idea that vibrations could actually sort of soothe Parkinson's. And this is a very interesting idea which has been tested. It's like you could sit in a massage chair and you feel better. And it seems like it's largely a placebo effect, but there was all kinds of attempts like that, but really there was nothing remotely that worked before levodopa, which was discovered in the 50s and 60s, and it worked so incredibly well that people thought at the time this was a cure, and everything was, I mean, I've seen films of people who are like statues, and you give them levodopa and they can stand up and walk and write, and the character returns to their face. So that was a really remarkable breakthrough when it happened.
We'll talk about that in just a minute. We're going to take a break here from our conversation with John Palfreyman, who is Professor Emeritus of Journalism at the University of Oregon and author of the new book Brainstorms, The Race to Unlock the Mysteries of Parkinson's Disease. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
The This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist John Palfreyman about his new book, Brainstorms, The Race to Unlock the Mysteries of Parkinson's Disease. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, John, levodopa or L-DOPA was the first treatment to be discovered that really did a lot more than any placebo. How was it found? How was it discovered? And how did people think that this might be something they could apply to the problems that are caused by Parkinson's?
Well, it was discovered by some experiments in animals, which then were applied to people. But people were very, but scientists were very skeptical at first because it seemed levodopa wasn't, well, let me back up. So dopamine is now recognized as being what's called a neurotransmitter, a chemical in the brain, one of several crucial chemicals in the brain. But at the time, it wasn't regarded as that. It was regarded as just a mere intermediate chemical. And some experiments in Sweden with rabbits proved that basically this, it had the power to sort of unfreeze. You could create a sort of Parkinson's model by giving rabbits a drug called rezepine, and then you could reverse it with levodopa. And that led to the idea that because they knew that pathologically the cells had been damaged in patients with Parkinson's, and that led to the hypothesis that if we gave patients with Parkinson's levodopa, they'd get better. And the first experiments, nobody really believed. They were done in Austria by a guy called Birkmeier. And then even in 1966, a double-blind trial was done, and it didn't show any effect. And it turned out that very large doses had to be given of this drug for enough of it to reach the brain. And when they sorted out the doses, that's when you started to get the amazing effects. And basically, you could take somebody who was in a wheelchair, completely frozen, unable to move, unable to talk in many cases. They couldn't write at all, and then you give them this, and a week or two later, they'd look normal, and it was like a miracle. And some people at the time thought this was the solution to Parkinson's. It was all going to be over.
The downside, of course, is that over time, and when taken at a particular dosage, levodopa can trigger a movement disorder of its own, something called dyskinesia.
Well, yes. You see, if you've got healthy neurons producing dopamine on demand, that's one thing. If you're pouring it in or you're taking a tablet which delivers it to your brain, it's not quite the same. And so after taking the drug for a while, it can be months or it can be years. It's usually years, 4 or 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, 8 years. You get what are called motor complications. So that the most noticeable one of these is called dyskinesias. And everybody who's seen Michael J. Fox, when he talks, he moves with involuntary movements that he can't control. And that's one of the things that happens. And another motor complication is that the medicine will suddenly switch off. It will fluctuate. It'll be going along, and then suddenly somebody who's walking can't walk because the medicine switches off and freezes. And so these motor complications mean that Parkinson's is still a major disease, and they make life more livable for patients. And people can stay on levodopa for years and years, but basically it's not a cure. And one of the challenges over the time has been to try and find a better way to deliver the levodopa. It's still taken by mouth as a pill, and that means it takes maybe half an hour or an hour to get to the brain. And then the brain gets a burst of it, and then the brain has to go without it. So if you had a more continuous method of delivery, that might be much better. But so far, they haven't really come up with anything terribly good, and it's been 50 years.
Hmm. All right, what is deep brain stimulation, and how does that work for some patients?
Well, deep brain stimulation is an amazing idea. It goes back to this heroic surgical tradition that surgeons sometimes discover things by accident. So they've been doing experiments, they've been doing operations, and in the history, a couple of surgeons slipped and sort of caused a blood vessel to bleed in a particular region of the brain, and the person's Parkinson got better and they thought this might be significant, that there were certain regions of the brain that if you lesioned them, one's called a, there's an operation called a pallidotomy, where you cut out a piece of the brain, and by cutting it out, it seemed to make people better. But this was obviously invasive surgery. So what deep brain stimulation did was replace the surgery with putting in an electrode which stimulated electricity to a certain specific brain region. And the whole idea is that you've got the brain's circuits have been upset because they're not getting enough dopamine. But if you go into one of these circuits and you blast it with the right kind of frequency and the right voltage of radiation, you can moderate some of the symptoms like the tremor or the rigidity. And it's quite a complex procedure. It's a 6-hour operation. You have to have it done on both sides of the brain. But when it works, it's utterly dramatic. You know, while the person has these electrodes implanted and a battery which is put into the chest, and it's like a pacemaker for the brain, and while it's going on, their disability is much reduced. But it doesn't always work, and any kind of neurosurgery is a risky procedure, so it's not something that's recommended for everybody. Something like 10 to 15% of patients take advantage of it. But there's evidence suggesting that there's some big breakthroughs in deep brain stimulation coming, so it may be becoming much more delicate and specific and sophisticated in the future. At the moment, you just turn it on and leave it. But I think they're thinking of deep brain stimulation models in the future where it would recognize, say, when I was about to tremor in my left hand, and then something would turn on and stop it.
Wow. I was going to ask, for those patients that it doesn't work for or who experience side effects after the implants are installed, can they be removed? Can the process be reversed?
Yes, it's reversible. So that's one of the advantages. If it doesn't work, you just take it out. And they're back where they started.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Harry on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Harry.
Hello. I was wondering whether he had heard of Dr. Norman Deutsch's work. Dr. Norman Deutsch was one of the first writers to write on neuroplasticity. And his second book was The Brain's Way of Healing, and in which he reports a case of a man who had Parkinson's disease, but by walking at a certain speed every day and walking so many miles, he managed to control his symptoms. Whenever he had a problem that prevented him from walking, those symptoms would return. But during the period of time that he was being able to walk, the symptoms disappeared so much that people who just observed him without checking his medical records and without doing any other tests assumed that he did not have Parkinson's disease, but he did.
Thanks for your call, Harry.
That's fascinating, Harry. I mean, I'm not familiar with that particular case, but what you suggest, there's two things come to mind. The role of exercise is extremely important in Parkinson's, and people who exercise regularly and walk regularly, like this gentleman you say, can do extremely well. And the second point is that there seem to be hidden areas of competence. One of the most remarkable things about Parkinson's is you can have an individual who can't walk. So there's a classic video of a Dutch patient who can't walk, who falls over in the corridor, but he can get on a bicycle, and he can ride a bicycle because riding a bike takes a different brain circuit, and he's able to do that. He rides the bike, he executes a turn, and he comes back. And this is a person who is too disabled to walk. So I think this notion that I'm not so sure whether it's neuroplasticity would be the benefits of regular exercise. So that basically it would be good for everything, and it would help your brain to sort of maintain itself. But then the other issue is that there's paradoxical movements. The brain is a very complicated sort of machine, and there's all kinds of little bits which are spared. And you find people who can ice skate and bike but can't walk, and people who can swim. And so it's very fascinating where these paradoxical capacities still remain in somebody who seems disabled.
It's fascinating, and also, if you're experiencing it, it has to be maddening at the same time.
Absolutely. It's very difficult to make sense of. You can imagine having a body that's responded in a certain way all your life, and now it won't. So when you want to do something simple like pick up a piece of spaghetti on a fork, it becomes difficult. But I think that the positive way is to say that really there, it's not all bad. That actually, if you exercise regularly, you may discover that you've got all kinds of preserved functions that are still there, and it will do you the world of good, because the big risks for people as they become progressively worse with Parkinson's are falling over and having the effects of a bad fall, which makes them withdraw from life and stay less engaged and so forth. So I can't emphasize at all that my research has showed that exercise makes an enormous difference between people with Parkinson's.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Katie in Dallas. Hi, Katie.
Hi. Thank you so much for all your insight. I was really wondering how you think would be the best way to help support people in our lives or people that we know who are going through Parkinson's.
Well, are you a caregiver for somebody with Parkinson's?
No, but in my high school, there was a principal or an assistant principal, I believe, that had Parkinson's. And in high school, I didn't really understand it. And I know at some point in my life, I'm sure I'll come into contact with someone who has Parkinson's. And I was wondering how the best way is to support someone who has that.
I think you've got to be a mixture of comforting and demanding. I mean, it's very natural when somebody gets Parkinson's to withdraw. They lose their self-confidence, and they want to stay at home because they're worried people will judge them, and they're not sure that they can do many of the things they used to do. And so you've got to simultaneously be supportive and understanding of that mindset, but actually encourage people to actually go and keep trying, because Just as the example of the person who could ride a bike but couldn't walk, I mean, shows there's lots of things you can still do. You might not be able to do everything, but you can still do a lot, and you won't know unless you try them. And so I would advise you to be simultaneously comforting but challenging at the same time. It's a real problem for caregivers, just as patients. When I first got the diagnosis, I passed through a stage of anger and denial, and it took me a while to accept it. Caregivers have the same process to go through before they, you know, come to terms with the fact that their lives are going to be changed because they're living with a person who's got a neurodegenerative disease that's probably not going to be going anywhere soon.
Scientists, John, are excited about human clinical trials of a drug called neurophage, or maybe it's neurophage, starting within the next year or two, made from a naturally occurring virus. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, this is an extraordinary story, and it's not the only game in town, but it's one of the most interesting. So basically, the modern theory of the pathology of Parkinson is that it might be caused by a protein called alpha-synuclein, which goes rogue. It misfolds and forms sticky clumps, and these sticky clumps sort of jump from cell to cell, killing cells in their wake. If you can imagine like a zombie movie, when a zombie touches a person and they become zombified, this is a misfolded protein which sticks to another protein and passes on its shape. And so these misfolded proteins, these amyloids, which as they're called, suggest a strategy, which is to go in with an agent and dissolve it. And it turned out that this company, Neurophage, which is Cambridge-based, are working off an idea which came from a humble virus which seemed to have just evolved the capacity to dissolve not only alpha-synuclein but other amyloids that occur in other neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. And they've created a medicine based on this, which they're going to go into clinical trials either next year, 2016 or 2017, probably 2016. And there's several other companies which have similar products which are there. And the potential here is pretty high, because if it worked, and you gave it to somebody who had either very early stage Parkinson, or even better, if you could if you could predict who was going to get it in 5 years' time, then you potentially stop the pathological process, and they'd never really get serious Parkinson's disease. And then for somebody like me who already had motor problems with Parkinson's but isn't suffering from anything like cognitive failure or some of the other things that happen later on, you could stop the process getting any worse. And so this is a classic disease-modifying strategy, which if it worked would change the game, the name of the game. But we've been here in the past, and as my book says, there's been some big disappointments in the past of things which have disease-modifying strategies which seemed like they were working, which turned out not to. So you've always got to be a little bit careful with biomedical research because it has a history of disappointing you at times.
Why are men more susceptible to Parkinson's than women?
Well, nobody knows this, but basically, and this is true that there's roughly 3 men for every 2 women who get Parkinson's, except in Japan, where the case is the reverse, and nobody really knows this is why. But in Alzheimer's disease, more women get that than men, so it balances out that way. But nobody's got any clue as to why that is at the moment that I've heard.
As a patient and also someone who has done a lot of journalism on this subject, when you hear about new therapies in development, I mean, are you in a better position to sort of temper your optimism than other people who, you know, you hear about any possibility and it's hard not to get really, really excited about it?
Well, fortunately, I've been a science journalist all my life, and so the science journalist in me takes the view that really it's about truth. You know, we're seeking what's really true, and so there's no point believing in something that isn't true. But on the other hand, the patient in me needs hope, and so it's a combination of the search for truth but keeping hope alive for things that are coming in the future.
John Palfreyman is my guest. He's Professor Emeritus of Journalism at the University of Oregon and author of the new book, Brainstorms, The Race to Unlock the Mysteries of Parkinson's Disease. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Courses include art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with science journalist John Palfreyman. His new book is called Brainstorms, The Race to Unlock the Mysteries of Parkinson's Disease. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about some strange, potentially preventive effects that come from things like caffeine and nicotine. Cautioning here that no doctor anywhere is encouraging patients to smoke to prevent anything, but what might be the reasons that nicotine and caffeine prevent this disease?
Well, they're drugs and they act on certain receptors, so the nicotine receptors may be involved in mediating some of the channels which lead to death. But you're right that this has come from epidemiological studies, surveys, which has found that people who smoke and people who drink a lot of coffee are less likely to contract Parkinson than those who don't. And the converse would be people who are around pesticides are more likely to contract Parkinson than people who aren't around pesticides. But there's a sort of hand-waving explanation. It's got something to do with the nicotine or caffeine receptors. So it makes sense, but nobody's so far suggested the smoking cure.
Right. Is anybody looking into like nicotine delivered transdermally or in some other way?
Well, they're looking into nicotine drugs which use those receptors, right?
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372. We have Mike on the line in Grapevine. Hello, Mike.
Oh, hi. Thanks for the show. It's great. My father and his older brother both contracted Parkinson's disease and were diagnosed fairly young. They were born in 1916 and 1918, respectively, and I was under the impression there was some research that showed that there was a connection between Parkinson's and an encephalitis outbreak that occurred around the end of World War One. I was wondering if that's, in fact, still believed.
Well, that's true. That's the writer Oliver Sacks wrote about that in his book Awakenings, that around 1918 there was an encephalitis lethargicus outbreak, and this is a Parkinson-like condition. So the people became Parkinsonian, but it's not the same disease as Parkinson's disease. And what Oliver Sacks did many years later was he gave them L-DOPA, and they sort of came back to life. They had a form of sleeping sickness. They were just very sort of low energy because of this. Given the dates of your relatives, it's an interesting sort of possibility. The pathology is different. It's not caused by alpha-synuclein. It's not caused by what are called Lewy bodies, which are found in the brains of deceased Parkinson patients. It's a different protein called tau, which is found in Alzheimer's disease, but it is a form of Parkinson's, but just not typical. But it's a very interesting question. I don't know how it's got a slightly different clinical pathway. So if you were able to get the medical records, you might be able to find out whether they had this rather than regular Parkinson's disease.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the phone, we'll speak with Margarita in Dallas. Hi, Margarita.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My father died of Parkinson's about 6 years ago, and I was very involved in Dallas with the Parkinson's community for a while. And one of the things that I found was that a lot of the conversation was involved around Sinemet, levodopa, and the cure. And what I saw from meeting Parkinson's patients in Fort Worth and in South South County was that there was not a conversation about the programs, exercise, activities to improve Parkinsonians' quality of life, which was something that they really, really wanted and really, really lacked from doctors and society as a whole. So as a researcher and somebody who lives with Parkinson's, what has your experience been over the years related to that? You know, I live in a city that does not offer Parkinson's patients much.
What can you tell us about that, John?
Well, that's a very interesting question. You'll find that this disease was dominated by neurologists for a long time, and it's only recently that physical therapists have become in who are more likely to push the role of exercise. Some countries like Holland, exercise through physical therapy is a standard feature that you get when you get a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. And there are some areas, I think in Florida, some Parkinson groups which believe it here, but it's much less well established in this country. And so personally for myself, I'm a terrific believer in exercise. Whether or not I get it prescribed for me by my neurologist, I try to walk 4 or 5 miles every day fast and do swimming and exercise. And I couldn't recommend, it's never too late to do it. So even if you're disabled and you can't walk, you might be able to ride a stationary bike. So I recommend you at every stage you try and do that. But I think that the caller makes an excellent point that politically it's only really fairly recently that the role of physical therapists and other adjunct professionals being involved in the care. And it's been heavily centered on just the people who prescribe drugs like levodopa. Sinemet is the same, is just a trade name for levodopa.
Back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. Let's speak with Ken in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Yes, hi. A comment and then a question. My father has had Parkinson's for the past 18 years, And you're right, there is a paradox, because the last, you know, 10 of those 18 years, he was in the Dallas Opera Orchestra playing the cello, and, you know, he played it. He was way into his disease by the time that he eventually had to give it up. My question to you is, again, my mother had Alzheimer's. My aunt had multiple sclerosis. If you have to have one of these, and it's a tough question, is this the one that's the easiest to cope with?
I would think so, but that I'm biased. I mean, the story you told about your father playing playing the cello is a wonderful story. And you find stories like this among people with Parkinson's. One of the great things about being a member of this community is you find people who've been able to achieve a lot even though they've got a diagnosis. And I don't think that's likely to be as true with Alzheimer's. So there's a British surveyor who got Parkinson's early, who walked around the coastline of Great Britain 4,500 miles and raised enough money to form his own Parkinson charity. There's a New York ballet dancer called Pamela Quinn, who I write about in the book, who teaches Parkinson patients how to trick their bodies into moving well. And there's an engineer from Sweden called Sarah Rigari, who's formed a company to try and invent wearable sensors, gadgets that you can take while you walk and help you judge, optimize your exercise and medication. So I've lost the track of your original question, but I think that the key thing is, you know, you've really got to take advantage of what's there and learn from the people who like your father who embraced life to the full as long as he could.
I was fascinated in the chapter that you wrote about Pamela. Can you tell us a little bit about how she developed some of these, what amount to, she called them tricks, I think, to sort of keep her body functioning at the best that it could be as a dancer, a lifelong, you know, athlete and artist who then had to manage this condition?
Well, dancers know, they have a lot of intrinsic bodily wisdom about what's going on. And so she codified a lot of those things into tricks that she could teach people. For example, she said, you want to use imagery. There's a tendency to sort of stoop when you walk as a Parkinson patient. So she said, you've got to imagine you're a model, like, you know, or like Beyonce, you know, so you lean back and you keep your head up and so forth. There's a tendency for some advanced patients to freeze and get stuck when they're approaching a narrow doorway. And she said, if you think like a penguin and move side to side, that will free up your ability to move and so forth. So she's got all kinds of tricks which she's developed because she knows, like a dancer, her body. She understands it very well, and she teaches these classes. I've been to several of them, and they're very good fun, and people get a lot of benefit out of it.
It seems that there's a lot of benefit to staying. You know, you mentioned staying physically active. Staying socially active seems to be really good too.
Absolutely. And you can see this, the young onset Parkinson patients who get the disease at age 30, they don't have any choice but to participate. They've got a lot of their life left and so forth. The tendency, you know, the risk for somebody who gets Parkinson when they're 60 or 65 is to say, well, I'm retired. You know, I'm at the end of my life. I'm not going to do much. But that's a recipe for disaster. You've got to find a way to make the best of it. And I think you've got to... The other advice, which seems to me to make sense, is to live in the moment, right? Don't worry about how you're going to end up, because you don't know what's going to happen down the road. But carpe diem, make the most of what you've got now while you're as functional as possible. And I think that's the best way to look at it.
We have an email here from Anne, who wants to know if any work is being done investigating a diet without animal protein as either a treatment for or preventive for Parkinson's.
I'm unfamiliar with that, but it's quite possible that diet would make some difference in managing your symptoms. It's not likely to be a cause of Parkinson one way or another, but there's so many things which can help, and I think you've just got to be experimental and find out what works for you.
Let's go to the phones now and speak with William in Weatherford. Hi, William.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Yes. I was diagnosed with Parkinson's 2 years ago, and my main complaint, I have no tremors. my main complaint is feelings of anxiety, sadness, depression. I have tried many medications. Nothing seems to help the anxiety and depression. I wonder if the author has anything that he can suggest.
I'm very sympathetic with that, that 50% of Parkinson patients suffer from anxiety and depression. And I've suffered from a certain amount of anxiety myself, and I fully understand it's very difficult to find a medication that doesn't actually make things worse. So I would advise you to try and find non-pharmacological ways of managing your anxiety and depression as well. Are there any activities or times at which you feel your best?
Later in the day, when I wake up in the morning, I lie in bed, say 5-6 o'clock. That's when the anxiety and worries really kick in. I tried Xanax, right. And that seems to be what I'm taking now.
No, this is a very familiar story, and I can only give you what would work for me, which is to get started. And I mean, it's quite normal for anxiety to be worse at the morning when people get up, because they've got the day lurking in front of them and they don't know what's going to happen. But the fact that you feel a lot better in the evening shows that, you know, you can get this under control. Because in the evening you're feeling better because you're feeling more relaxed and you... I mean, that's you've got to somehow work with that. I mean, work with what works for you. But I do understand this. I don't have any brilliant solutions to it, but all I can say is this is a common symptom for people with Parkinson's.
Did you feel better emotionally when you sort of took the bull by the horns, like decided you were going to acknowledge the disease and also to continue exploring it as a journalist rather than sort of telling only your wife and your children?
I felt way better. Mm-hmm. I mean, that one of the things that's quite interesting about when you get a disease like this is you're tempted to keep it secret, and I kept it secret for as long as I could because you don't want to be treated any differently. You don't want to be pitied. And you also want to sort of think, if you can blend in with the world of the well, it can't be so bad. But when you get through all that stuff and admit that what you've got is a disease and your life's going to be different, then for me it became almost not an opportunity, more like a destiny, that I had to use my skills as a journalist and my insights as a patient to try and explore this malady, which was now going to be a part of my life for the foreseeable future, and it has helped enormously. It's a wonderful community, and one of the things about getting a disease is you join a tribe of people that, and you get to know people you wouldn't have known otherwise. And some of these people are truly inspiring, and so I recommend the last caller to see whether he can to reach out, even though you may not feel like it, to reach out to other people with Parkinson's and see what you can learn from them.
John Palfreyman is Professor Emeritus of Journalism at the University of Oregon. His new book is called Brainstorms, The Race to Unlock the Mysteries of Parkinson's Disease. John, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you for making this time for us.
My pleasure, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Braylon Becton. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show's email address is think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.